Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 27th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, how to synchronize optical clocks, Europe's earliest farmers, and the difficulties of eradicating measles, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
While synchronizing your watch with your cell phone may be a piece of cake, aligning optical clocks is no easy feat. Optical atomic clocks are among the most precise time-measuring devices in existence. Many experiments in quantum physics and electrodynamics require multiple optical clocks at different locations to be in sync, but satellite transmissions limit our ability to compare these powerful devices. To forge a better link, a team of scientists in Germany tested a 920-kilometer fiber-optic cable and achieved an unprecedented level of precision. Lead author Katerina Pradil spoke with me about the work.
We have, in a collaboration between the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics in Munich and the PTB in Braunschweig, which is the German version of NIST, established and characterized an optical fiber link that eventually will allow us to compare optical clocks.
And by compare, you mean synchronize?
Yeah, in principle, synchronize.
So, refresh my memory. How exactly does an optical clock work?
An optical clock is a clock that ticks very fast. It ticks a million times faster than the currently used atomic clocks that operate in the microwave region. And an optical clock works by forcing an electron inside an atom to emit very well-defined radiation, or the radiation that has a very well-defined frequency, and this frequency you can use as a clock signal. And this makes them very precise.
So what are the current methods being used for communication between optical clocks today, and what's the problem with that? What are you trying to fix?
Okay, so there is actually no adequate method to compare optical clocks right now. For microwave clock systems, it would be satellite-based techniques such as GPS or the two-way time and frequency transfer. And in the case of optical clocks, there's a problem. There's very little number of experiments worldwide that employ optical clocks. Optical clocks are very complex systems and very high maintenance. And if you want to perform measurements using these kind of clocks, sooner or later you wish to compare it to another clock system that is likely in a remote laboratory. And this is the reason why people have thought about fiber links as an alternative.
But you're not just thinking about this fiber optic cable. You're actually using over 900 kilometers worth of fiber optic cables laid out across Germany. So first, where do these cables lead to and from?
So the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics is located quite south of Germany, and PTB is located rather north. And they pass actually a main part of the German country.
And how effective is this fiber link in comparing optical clocks?
The fiber link that we have characterized and tested allows to fully exploit the potential of even the most accurate optical clocks in the world.
And this is where the residual uncertainty in the measurements comes in. In your paper, you've quoted a number of 4 times 10 to the negative 19 as your uncertainty. Can you explain what exactly this number represents and how significant it is?
So this 10 to the minus 19 is a relative uncertainty. So what that means is if I have a certain frequency, let's say I have a 10 gigahertz signal, it will be shifted by a fraction of few parts of 10 to the 19. If you prefer absolute numbers, then we can convert this 10 to the minus 19 to a little less than 100 microhertz. So the optical signal that we send, which is actually a frequency of 200 terahertz, won't be shifted by more than a few microhertz. So the currently stated residual uncertainty for the best optical clocks that are actually operated at NIST is little less than 10 to the minus 17, to my knowledge. And that we are below this level means that we can compare these two clocks to their full extent. That means our experiment won't limit such a clock comparison. It was incredible to demonstrate, but it is also a prerequisite for the comparison of optical clocks. Otherwise, you would be limited by the transmission.
What is the key to your technique? How are you able to attain such a high level of precision over the length of your cable?
So first of all, you have to imagine, as I just mentioned, this fiber link passes basically a main part of the country. So we pass highways, we pass cities, we pass railway tracks, and so on. So the fiber will be shaken. It will be vibrating. There will be temperature fluctuations and many nasty things that will disturb the clock signal while it is transferred to the other institute. So what we want to make sure is that the transfer between the two institutes won't shift the frequency of this clock signal. So on the one hand, we have employed an active stabilization of the fiber length in order to compensate for all these fluctuations that we have. And on an entire distance of 900 kilometers, we have managed to keep the fiber length stable on average to a length that is comparable to fractions of an atom.
Wow.
And the second thing is that we need to amplify the signal. So as you can imagine, this 900 kilometers passing this glass fiber, the light will be absorbed. And we have implemented 9 specially designed amplifier systems in order to keep the signal level constant in order to be able to use it as a remote signal.
Wow, that is absolutely incredible, that level of precision.
Yeah. So this has not been the first experiment that has been done with fiber links. So there have been fiber links before, but one of the great achievements of this experiment is that it bridges such a large distance.
Ah, so what's innovative here is not the fact that you've used a fiber optic cable, but it is actually the way in which you've accounted for the distance and the variations along its length.
Yeah, and that we still can achieve this incredibly small number of 10 to the minus 19 by basically passing a whole country.
So what kinds of applications require such agonizingly precise time measurements?
So as you may know, atomic microwave clocks today define or realize the definition of the second. And in future, this likely will be performed by optical clocks. So at the moment, there is a high interest to compare all these different clock systems among each other in order to find an appropriate candidate for a future primary standard. This would be one application. Other applications have actually been published in your journal. So this is fundamental physics, for example, to show that the fundamental constants do not drift above a certain level. And other applications would be to test the gravitational redshift on a centimeter scale. So this would be the applications in fundamental research.
And I imagine studies of relativity, subatomic particle acceleration, things like that?
Yes.
Now, we've all heard of this study of faster-than-light neutrinos that came out in late 2011. And we probably also know about the uncertainty that's been cast upon the findings because of some discrepancy, some small number of nanoseconds in the travel of these particles. So do you think if they had been using your fiber optic link, would there have still been this uncertainty in their measurements?
What I have read is that it was a loose fiber cable. So in the end, they could have made the same mistake even by using a fiber link, actually.
Okay.
So we all hoped that it would be helpful to have a fiber link instead, but it was just a loose cable. And this can always happen. This can happen to you at home.
Well, great. Katerina Pradil, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Katerina Pradil reports on a 920-kilometer fiber optic link for optical clocks in this week's issue.
The Neolithic age was marked by the transition from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to the more stationary one of agriculture. But this transition did not occur in all parts of the world at the same time. Matthias Jacobson and colleagues sought to better understand how this lifestyle change came to Europe by looking at DNA from ancient human remains. I spoke to Jacobson about the spread of farming on the European continent from his office in Uppsala, Sweden.
So we did a study about this long-term question about how farming spread across the European continent, say 11,000 years ago, starting in the Middle East and then ending up in Northern Europe 6,000 years ago. So the big debate here has been whether it's a spread of ideas, so basically word to mouth, or the other way of describing this hypothesis is if it's actually people moving from the Middle East, bringing the ideas of farming with them and basically replacing the local hunter-gatherers that are living in Europe at the time. So you have two distinct hypotheses. Either it's a spread of ideas or if it's a spread of people bringing the farming ideas. So what we did, compared to what has been done before, was actually to go to these groups of people, the Neolithic or the Stone Age farmers and the Stone Age hunter-gatherers, and get DNA from these remains and look at genetic similarities to current-day Europeans.
What can you tell us about the remains that you looked at and that you used in this study?
So we know from archaeological record that there's this group of hunter-gatherers living throughout Europe at the time of introduction of farming, and they have some distinct artifacts that separate them from the people who are bringing farming. So for an archaeologist, it's quite easy to distinguish whether a site with human remains belongs to a hunter-gatherer group or to a farmer group. So, for example, pottery is the classical marker. But there's also many other markers of whether it's a farming group or if it's a hunter-gatherer group. For example, the megalithic burial structures that the farmers build don't appear in hunter-gatherer sites where they use flatbed graves, for example.
Huh. And these remains that you extract DNA from, can you tell us about where they particularly were found?
So they were both the Neolithic hunter-gatherers and the Neolithic farmers were excavated in Scandinavia in Sweden. So they actually are two groups that live less than 400 kilometers away from each other. And these two groups seem to have been living there for, say, 1,000 years, and that's 30, 40 generations, reasonably stable populations.
Hmm. And so you took these remains and you extracted DNA from them. How does DNA hold up after 5,000 years?
Of course, DNA breaks down over time, but 5,000 years is not a huge amount of time. So there's reasonable amounts of authentic human DNA in these remains. Of course, it's a big challenge because there's going to be DNA from lots of other organisms, bacteria, and such in these remains. So for these remains that we looked at, we got between 2% and 6% of authentic human DNA from the remains.
And then you also have to worry about contamination from modern humans.
Right. And that's probably the much more severe issue. So we addressed it in a number of ways, and maybe the two most important ones is that we had animal remains treated in the exact same pipeline as the human remains. And for those ones, we get less than 0.12% of the data that we get out mapped to the human genome. That's probably not even contamination. It's probably just reads that are mapping to the human genome because it's a seal on the dog that we use as positive controls. So the second thing that we also do, there's a specific ancient DNA damage pattern in old DNA molecules. So in the data that we get, we can pick out those molecules that have that exact ancient DNA signature. And then we can repeat all our analysis only with that subset of data where we are sure that it's really ancient DNA, and then we get exactly the same results as when we use all the human DNA that we get from the remains.
So you relied on the fact that the DNA does degrade over time to prove that you were using ancient DNA.
Exactly. So instead of seeing these ancient DNA damages as a nuisance or a problem, we actually use them to authenticate that it is ancient things that we're looking at.
And so you were sure you had a pure sample and that it was representative of that time. What did you find when you compared it with modern people?
So we had these two groups, the hunter-gatherers and the farmers. And the Neolithic hunter-gatherers, they, if you compare them to a large number of European populations today, they resemble northern European populations. So Finnish, people from Russia, people from Orkney Islands, but not a perfect match in any sense. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Neolithic farmers, surprisingly, clustered or resembled mostly Mediterranean Europeans from today. So these are two groups then living in Scandinavia, less than 400 kilometers away, and they are kind of encompassing the greatest genetic differences that we see in Europe today.
So what does it suggest about the way farming propagated across the continent?
It tells us that the farming actually were brought by people moving probably over many generations across the European continent. And so it's people who bring the ideas to a new region. But it's not as simple as that. So it's not that there's no traces of the hunter-gatherers remaining anymore. So what we think is going on is that people are bringing the ideas, and then after a while they start mixing with the local hunter-gatherers, and that's what creates today's patterns of variation across Europe.
This was a really interesting point that you brought up in the paper, that your Neolithic samples were not very similar to modern Swedes. How does that fit into what the rest of your findings?
So that fits in quite well, because what we think is going on here is that you have these local hunter-gatherers living throughout Europe, and then you have migrating farmers coming further and further north, and probably it's fewer and fewer individuals coming further and further north. So today's Scandinavians and Swedes are a mix of these two groups, and you can actually see that the further north you get in Sweden, the greater fraction of local hunter-gatherer genes do you keep, and in this kind of south part of Sweden, you have more of the farming, Neolithic farmer genes.
Huh. Farmers didn't go that far north because farming wasn't very profitable that far north, would you say?
Probably, and it's probably a gradient. So the further away you go from the center of where farming started, you just get fewer people coming to that area.
And how generalizable would you say this result is? You looked at, you know, just a few individuals from the Neolithic age, and you're talking about something that happened over all of Europe.
Right. So the sample size of the farmer is one here, but we have very good indications that this individual is not a unique individual in this particular population where it's living. It has the same signatures as other remains that have been excavated in that area. And also, we know that these Neolithic farmers that live in Scandinavia, they're reasonably similar to those Neolithic farmers that live in Central Europe. So they have basically similar artifacts associated with them. And there's also been mitochondrial studies that suggest that basically the same mitochondrial haplogroups are present in these, both the Scandinavian farmers and the Central European farmers. So we think that this really represents a group of Neolithic farmers that spread across Europe, and they, of course, have to go through Central Europe to get to the northern part of Europe.
Well, Matthias Jacobsen, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, sir.
Matthias Jacobsen and colleagues write about the legacy of Neolithic farmers and hunter-gatherers in Europe in this week's Science.
Europe has a problem that just won't go away, the measles virus. Following the success of the measles vaccine after it was made available in 1963, the World Health Organization set a target of eliminating the disease in Europe by 2010, a deadline that was later pushed back to 2015 and is expected to be deferred yet again. While North and South America have all but eliminated measles, why is Europe still struggling? Kai Kupferschmidt, author of a news focus on the subject, spoke with me about how vaccine non-compliance gets started.
Basically, the story is about the fact that measles in Europe has recently resurged, so numbers of measles cases in Europe have really increased in the last 2 or 3 years. And people are pretty worried, I guess, because in 2012, there's also two big sporting events. There's the Euro Cup in Ukraine and Poland, and then there's the Olympics in London. So people are worried that these might also be hubs where the measles virus gets transmitted further. And the WHO agreed on a goal of eliminating the measles virus in the European region by 2015. And at the moment, that seems to be almost impossible. And people are really looking for solutions to getting to that goal.
So how dangerous a disease is measles?
Well, there are two answers to that question, really. So first of all, it is more dangerous than most people in Western societies probably think. We tend to see it as a harmless childhood disease, but measles still kills children. I mean, according to the newest estimates, in 2010, 139,000 children died of measles. So it's a very serious disease still. And there are actually estimates that before a vaccine was available, more than 2 million children died every year of measles.
Wow.
At the same time, it depends a lot on where a child lives that gets the measles virus. So in a low socioeconomic setting, up to 1 in 10 infected children might die. while in Europe it is probably closer to 1 in 3,000 children. And that's simply because the way that the measles virus kills people is mostly indirect. So if you're infected with the virus, that leads to a weakening of the immune system. And most deaths from measles in the world are due to secondary bacterial or viral infections. So in places like India or sub-Saharan Africa, you know, you have the highest burden of measles mortality because of that. But still, even in Europe, the virus can kill. 1 in 1,000 patients developed encephalitis, so that's an infection in the brain, that often results in permanent brain damage. And there are other complications which even in Europe can lead to death.
Why is Europe so worried that it won't be able to eliminate this disease?
Almost all the deaths of measles in the world occur in poor countries. At the same time, in those countries, it is really just a question of delivering the vaccine. So in theory, we know what to do about this problem. There's a cheap, effective vaccine that we just need to get to people just to deliver it. In Europe, it's a whole different problem because the vaccine is there, it can be delivered, there's the money to vaccinate people, but people just don't get their children vaccinated enough. And there are many experts who are now saying, in the end, Europe might actually be the last place where there will be a reservoir of measles virus. So while in all of these other places we are seeing a lot of progress, in Europe, we just don't know how to tackle the problem. And, for example, Diane Griffin, a measles expert from the U.S., is convinced that in the end, Europe will be the place that keeps the measles virus from being eradicated.
What are the reasons for this? Why aren't children being vaccinated in Europe? Why is the continent having such a tough time meeting these World Health Organization targets?
Well, people have been arguing about that in the last few months, and certainly there is fear of the vaccine. In the UK, there was the big story about Andrew Wakefield, a gastroenterologist, who made a connection between the measles vaccine and autism in children, which was later refuted and actually it was shown that the work was fraudulent. But that certainly increased fears. And a lot of parents, if they have the option of vaccinating the children against the disease that they see as, you know, a childhood disease that's not that dangerous, and then they have these kind of unspecific fears of what a vaccine might do, that is one of the hard things. So you have fear of side effects of the vaccine. You also have just complacency because measles just aren't seen as that important a virus anymore. Really, a lot of people are saying vaccines have become, you know, victims of their own success because we don't see these diseases that much anymore. So the incentive for actually getting vaccinated is just a lot lower than it used to be. So the other big factor that people are talking about is just convenience. For a lot of people, it's just a question of, you know, when do I get my children vaccinated? Do I have the time to do it? When people are asked why they haven't vaccinated their children, a lot of people will answer, I just didn't have the time, or I simply forgot about it. So another problem in vaccinating people can just be reaching certain marginalized groups. In Europe, there's the Roma population, which hasn't got that much access to healthcare, and in a lot of cases, actually, measles have been spread in Europe by people from this ethnic minority. So people are really trying to integrate them better in healthcare. And then also you have groups that, on religious grounds or philosophical grounds, oppose vaccination, like the anthroposophic community or even certain Protestant groups that just oppose vaccination and will not get their children vaccinated because of it.
Well, the Americas suffer many of those same roadblocks, and yet we've nearly wiped out measles here. So what was the key to our success?
That is really what European health officials are looking at and trying to understand. There might be a psychological factor, just that the memory of this disease is still a lot more pronounced in the Americas than it is in Europe, just because in Europe it hasn't been that big a problem for a long time. At the same time, there are people saying it's about making vaccination mandatory. For example, in the U.S., if you want to send your kids to school, you have to prove that they are vaccinated. Even many pediatricians will not accept children in their practice if they aren't vaccinated. And that is something that in Europe is being discussed, but the general consensus is that in Europe that wouldn't work for legal and for social reasons, that it's just seen as something very hard to do.
So it sounds a little bit like in Europe, nobody really knows who should be taking responsibility for this. Is it the government, the teachers, the parents, the doctors?
Yeah, I think it's a mix of all of these people. So one important thing is to also get doctors more involved, probably. You can really make out pockets of susceptibility. So if you look at vaccination coverage, you can even see around certain, you know, just in very small areas where one doctor will be opposed to vaccination, you will have very low vaccination rates. So really getting health professionals involved and making sure that they really want to vaccinate. But what it really comes down to is trying to really understand what these 10 to 20% of people who do not get their children vaccinated, what the reason for that behavior is, and then trying to address that. And at the moment, most health officials in Europe just don't feel they can answer that question adequately.
So have health officials been able to come up with any new approaches?
I think it's a little too early to say. Certainly, European health officials are starting to understand that they need new approaches. Mm. There's a lot of talk about internet campaigns or trying to get away from this idea of just educating people with posters and brochures and stickers and really trying to offer new vaccination campaigns where people can go after working hours just to make it more convenient for them. So these things are being discussed, but really it will be a big topic in the coming years to find out what the right approach will be to reach the people that at the moment are not getting their children vaccinated.
Right. Well, Kai Kupferschmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Contributing correspondent Kai Kupferschmidt is the author of a news focus on a measles resurgence in Europe.
Finally today, we've got David Grimm, online news editor of Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, David, let's start out with genetic scars.
Right. You know, we often talk about if kids are abused in childhood, it can leave emotional scars that last through life. Well, this is a sort of a scarring of a different type. A new study suggests that children that are abused or even bullied early in life actually have some genetic marks that can cause problems later in life.
So how can the DNA show evidence of this?
That's a good question. Well, it has to do with a part of the DNA known as telomeres. And telomeres are these caps on chromosomes. You can think of them a little bit like those sort of plastic nubs on the tops of your shoelaces that keep your shoelace from unraveling. Well, telomeres, similarly, they keep DNA from unraveling. But that's not all they do. They seem to be somehow correlated with the age of a cell. So the more times a cell divides, the shorter and shorter the telomere gets. So usually scientists can say, you know, if a cell has really short telomeres, it's also old. Short telomere length also correlates with things like diabetes, dementia, and fatigue. So the question in this new study was, because shortened telomeres have been associated with some of these bad things, and childhood stress has also been associated with some bad things, is there a correlation between the two? And what the researchers did was they looked at a very large twin study that's been going on. It's called the Environmental Risk Longitudinal Twin Study, which has followed 1,100 sets of British twins from birth to observe how genes and environment interact. And what the researchers did was they looked at some of the younger children in the study, and they asked their mothers about the children's experience of violence, things like, were the children physically abused? Were they bullied? Were they exposed to abuse from even their parents? And then the researchers looked at a particular gene within these children to see how many times it copied itself. And that's sort of a proxy for the length of the telomeres in these kids. And what the researchers found was that there was a direct relationship between the amount of violence these kids experienced and the length of their telomeres. The more violence, the shorter their telomeres were.
And so do they have a mechanism that they're proposing for this?
Well, it's a good question, Sarah. And they don't really know what's behind this, why violence would decrease telomere length, if it's even doing that. You know, again, this is just a correlation. But what's concerning is that, you know, as I talked about earlier, shortened telomeres have a lot of bad side effects. They seem to lead to a lot of what we would consider evidence of premature aging, whether it's early onset of disease or fatigue or things like that. So it suggests that children who are abused early in life not only bear these sort of emotional scars, but they actually may develop a lot of physical problems, and it may have something to do with the length of their telomeres.
Is there any evidence that they might be able to come back from this?
Yeah, well, the researchers actually found some evidence that seemed to suggest that children who had been abused early in life and then had been removed from those abusive situations seemed to have a recovery of the length of their telomeres. This is still really needs to be worked out, but if that's true, it offers some hope. It suggests that just because you're abused early in life, it doesn't mean that you're fated to these problems later in life. It could suggest that there's a way to reverse the effect just by removing somebody from that unpleasant situation.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with that. Next up, we have a story about why some people might be giving us the chills.
Right. So this study is all about, I guess, what we could call creepy people. And according to scientists, what sort of defines somebody as creepy, at least sort of psychologically, is somebody that to us appears like they're trying to be normal, but there's just something kind of off about them. For anybody who's seen the 1960 thriller Psycho and can think back to Norman Bates, what's sort of creepy about him is he looks normal, looks sort of clean cut and like a nice guy, but, you know, just by his mannerisms and everything else, it just seems like there's something sort of weird about him, right? And this new study shows that people like this, these sort of creepy people, can literally give us the chills, not just figuratively, but literally give us the chills.
So how did they demonstrate creepiness in their study?
Well, what they did was they had 40 college undergrads, and they had a female experimenter come in, and in some cases, the female experimenter would act really chummy with the person. Like she would say, like, oh, that's awesome or whatever, you know, act like she was really trying to be that person's friend. And in other cases, she was much more formal, just sort of very standoffish and very professional. At the same time, while she was doing either of these behaviors, she also sometimes mimicked a student's body language. So if somebody sort of slouched in their chair, she would also kind of slouch, or maybe she would fidget when they fidgeted. And other times she wouldn't mimic their behavior. And the reason mimicking is important is a little bit of mimicking is actually good. So if you and I are talking for a while, chances are we'll start to appropriate each other's mannerisms a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this is a sort of a well-known phenomenon, and it builds trust between people. But what they did with this study is they sort of switched things up. So if the experimenter was acting really chummy, she should have also been appropriating the other person's mannerisms. That's sort of what you would expect. What the experimenter did to sort of make herself be creepy was she would act really chummy. She'd say, like, awesome, but she wouldn't mimic somebody's mannerisms, or vice versa. She would mimic somebody's mannerisms, but act very formal at the same time. So sort of really create that sort of dissonance. And what the researchers found is that when the experimenter was essentially acting creepy, when her actions weren't really matching her mood, these students were filling out a questionnaire and they said they literally felt colder when this woman was essentially being creepier.
So there's the chills.
Right. She was literally sending chills down their spine.
Okay, so that tells me that I should mimic in moderation.
Well, you know, for most of us, it's not a concern. You know, a lot of the stuff we do unconsciously, whether it's mimicking somebody else's behavior or even sort of being very casual with somebody we know very well. I think what sets off the alarm in our brain is when somebody is maybe trying to do that, but clearly failing at it, you know, like a Norman Bates or maybe somebody else you could pick out of a more recent movie. And it just sort of suggests that there's a lot of stuff, you know, in our social interactions that we're picking up on a conscious level that really sort of clues us in into whether somebody is maybe not quite right.
Okay, and last up, we have a story about early animals and dermal bone. I thought this was really interesting.
Well, dermal bone is basically long plates of bone that sit beneath the skin. And this was actually very common in some of the first four-legged creatures, which are known as tetrapods, that walked on land, venturing out from the ocean or sort of evolving out of the ocean and walking on land. And scientists have been sort of unclear about what the function of this dermal bone was. It seemed to, like, would be really great body armor because you've got these sort of plates of bone in your skin. And so scientists have suggested that, you know, maybe they protected the blood vessels and the nerves of these early four-legged creatures, maybe also kept them warm and hydrated because it would have sort of provided another layer between their inside and the outside environment. But a new study proposes an additional function for this dermal bone, which is actually pretty fascinating.
Yeah, so instead of serving a protection purpose or an insulation purpose, it actually may serve as a reservoir of ions.
Right, exactly. It sort of literally prevented these creatures' blood from turning into acid, or at least from becoming very acidic. The problem that these early tetrapods would have had is that they would have had a hard time getting rid of their carbon dioxide. For us, it's really easy. We just breathe out and the carbon dioxide is gone. But for these early guys walking on land, they actually had very primitive lungs, which made it hard to inhale and exhale deeply. They also had ribs that were fixed in place, not like us, who we sort of have these floating ribs, which also made it hard to breathe in and out. And that meant when they exerted a lot of energy, whether it was chasing prey or being chased as prey, they would have built up a lot of carbon dioxide. And this would have actually theoretically made their blood very acidic, which would have been very bad. Researchers know that sort of more modern animals have a way of coping with this. For example, turtles spend a long time underwater and they're holding their breath, which means they're building up a lot of carbon dioxide. But to counteract for that, they have this dermal bone in their shell, which actually leaches calcium and magnesium ions into their bloodstream. And that actually counteracts any sort of acidity in the bloodstream. And the researcher said, well, maybe something very similar was happening with early tetrapods.
So how do they look at the pH balancing effect of dermal bone way in the past?
Well, yeah. So basically what they used is they went through a trove of early tetrapod fossils, and they found an interesting correlation. They found that big tetrapods, whose tissues would have produced large amounts of carbon dioxide, had a lot of dermal bone. And that makes sense. If you're holding in a lot of carbon dioxide and your dermal bone is helping sort of counteract the effects of that, you'd want a lot of it. And conversely, much smaller creatures had a relatively much smaller proportion of dermal bone. But it wasn't just that. The researchers also found that creatures that spent a lot more time in the water and therefore had probably had efficient gills to get rid of carbon dioxide didn't really have much dermal bone, whereas those creatures that weren't spending much of their time in the water anymore had a lot of dermal bone.
So perhaps a land adaptation.
Exactly.
Really interesting. Okay, well, what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story on glowing sharks. Also a story on how pigeons' brains are wired like GPS devices. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about the latest on the children's study. This is this massive proposed effort by the National Institutes of Health to follow 100,000 children in the U.S. from birth to 21 years of age. So what's the latest on that? Also, a congressional controversy about a scientific collaboration with China. And finally, on Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about these controversial avian flu studies that have really sort of raised a lot of questions about whether it's appropriate to publish all of your scientific data when it could potentially be used by bioterrorists or other people that are up to no good. And next week's Science Live is about the search for extraterrestrial life, the program known as SETI that's looking for aliens out there, and what is the latest that we know about who else is out there in the universe.
I'm going to tune into that one.
So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the April 27th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.